You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration has on a number of occasions spoken of the need to spread democracy in the Middle East. Afghanistan was to benefit from a democratic government, and democracy was to be established in Iraq. To date, Afghanistan is still in the hands of warlords and the Taliban. In Iraq, the U.S. blocked moves to elect a governing council. Russell Mokiver of the Corporate Crime Reporter examines another country where the U.S.'s promises of democracy have not been realized.
Recently in the Washington Post, Condoleezza Rice, the president's national security advisor, wrote the following. Our task is to work with those in the Middle East who seek progress toward greater democracy, tolerance, prosperity, and freedom. As President Bush said in February, the world has a clear interest in the spread of democratic values because stable and free nations do not breed ideologies of murder. They encourage the peaceful pursuit of a better life. Now, if we only had a nickel for every time Bush or Rice or Colin Powell or Paul Wolfowitz or Dick Cheney or Richard Pearl or Donald Rumsfeld talked about bringing democracy to the Middle East. Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz didn't hold a press conference last month to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the U.S.-led coup of the democratically elected leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. Rice and Powell didn't hold a press conference to celebrate Operation Ajax, the CIA plot that overthrew Mossadegh. That was 50 years ago last month, in August 1953. That's when Mossadegh was fed up with the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now BP, pumping Iran's oil and shipping the profits back home to the United Kingdom. And Mossadegh said, "This is our oil. I think we'll keep it." But Winston Churchill said, "No, you won't." Mossadegh nationalized the company the way the British were nationalizing their own vital industries at the time. But what's good for the UK ain't good for Iran. Now, why should we be concerned about a coup that happened so far away over 50 years ago? New York Times reporter Stephen Kinzer puts it this way. It's not far-fetched to draw a line from Operation Ajax through the Shah's repressive regime and the Islamic Revolution to the fireballs that engulfed the World Trade Center in New York. Kinzer has written a remarkable new book, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. In it, he documents, step by step, how President Theodore Roosevelt's grandson, Kermit Roosevelt, and how the Dulles boys and Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., among a host of others, took down a democratically elected regime in Iran. They had freedom of the press. We shut it down. They had democracy. We crushed it. Mossadegh was the beacon of hope in the Middle East. If democracy were allowed to take hold in Iran, it probably would have spread throughout the Middle East. We asked Kinzer, what does the overthrow of Mossadegh say about the United States' respect for democracy abroad? And this is what he said. Imagine today what it must sound like to Iranians to hear American leaders tell them, "We want you to have a democracy in Iran. We disapprove of your present government. We wish to help you bring democracy to your country." Naturally, they roll their eyes and say, "We had a democracy once, but you crushed it." This shows how differently other people perceive us from the way we perceive ourselves, Kinzer said. We think of ourselves as paladins of democracy, but actually in Iran, we destroyed the last democratic regime the country ever had and sent them on a road to what has been a half a century of dictatorship. After ousting Mossadegh, the United States put in place a brutal Shah who destroyed dissent and tortured the dissenters. And the Shah begat the Islamic Revolution. During the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iranians held up Mossadegh's picture, telling the world, "We want a democratic regime that resists foreign influence and respects the will of the Iranian people as expressed through democratic institutions." Kinzer says, they were never able to achieve that, and this has led many Iranians to react very poignantly to my book. One woman sent me an email that said, "I was in tears when I finished your book because it made me think of all we lost and all we could have had." Of course, the overthrow of Mossadegh was only one of the first U.S. coups of democratically elected regimes. So the next time a politician talks about spreading democracy around the globe, ask them about Mohammed Mossadegh in Iran, Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, and Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala.
Russell Mokyber of the Corporate Crime Reporter. We now turn to Mark Gasoriaski, professor of political science at Louisiana State University, speaking with Godarz Ektedari of community radio station KABU in Portland, Oregon. He described the 1953 CIA-led coup that removed democratically elected Iranian President Mohammad Mossadegh from power.
He had been a political figure in Iran since the early 1920s. After he came back from Europe, had been a lifelong opponent of the Pahlavi dynasty, both the first Pahlavi and the second Pahlavi, who was king at the time that he was prime minister. He was out of politics for a long time. He was pushed aside by the Shah's father. He came back into politics at the very end of World War II. There emerged in that period a movement to nationalize the oil industry, which at that time was owned and operated by the British, by the predecessor to British Petroleum. And so he became the leader of this movement in the late 1940s. But he really saw it as a movement that had two goals. One was to nationalize the oil industry and to regain, you know, Iranian control over its own economy. But second, he saw as intertwined with that, that his movement was to bring democracy to Iran, to end the domination that had been going on for quite some time of, you know, basically the landed oligarchy, which was very pro-British. Since the landed oligarchy was very closely tied to the British, he felt that these were two sides of the same struggle, bringing democracy to Iran and getting British control out of the Iranian economy. And so, you know, he led the oil movement. He was a figure, a member of the parliament. He eventually, you know, when the movement really culminated, when there was no alternative, the Shah realized that he had to appoint Mossadegh prime minister. This was in late April 1951. Immediately then, Mossadegh nationalized the oil industry and you know, began his efforts to transform Iran on these two levels that I've talked about. So he really was an extremely positive figure in Iran, and you know, one that anybody who has a progressive attitude would look favorably upon. The one thing that I would say, though, was that he was very obstinate. He was not very pragmatic. He was very much of an idealist, and I think that he really misunderstood the nature of world conditions at that time and Iran's role in that. And you know, in my view, he really waited too long. I think. If he had solved the oil crisis earlier, if he had reached an agreement with the British, things would have turned out very, very differently in Iran and much, much better for Iran. So although he was a great figure in many respects, I think that also his obstinacy was an important part of the problem and was part of the reason that the United States eventually decided to do this.
So in other words, he was not pragmatic with
Yes, he was not a pragmatic figure. He did not, you know, carefully look at the situation around him and act accordingly. He just held out and held out and held out. He was really too much of an idealist, I think.
As far as a U.S. Intervention goes, was this a change in foreign policy for the United States, or was it continuation of international?
Well, first of all, the United States before World War II, of course, had been very isolationist, or that is to say outside of the Western Hemisphere, had been very uninvolved. The United States had not really been involved at all in the Middle East before World War II. After World War II, the United States did, you know, move onto the global stage and get more involved in Europe and Asia and elsewhere. But initially, the U.S. was doing that in a relatively innocent way, I would say, and specifically the CIA, which was created only after World War II, although it did engage in some covert action in Europe in the late 1940s, trying to undermine the communist parties in France and Italy and trying to destabilize the Soviet bloc countries. That being said, it had never done anything like the 1953 coup in Iran. It had never undertaken actions that were hostile toward a pro-Western leader, and certainly it had never tried to overthrow a government in this kind of massive way that it did. So this really was a dramatic change. It was really the first big operation outside of Europe that CIA undertook. It was the first time the CIA tried to overthrow a government. It was really a massive operation and, you know, subsequently seen that way. It was the model for subsequent U.S. coup attempts in Guatemala, in Syria, in Iraq, in Chile, and probably in other places as well. So this really was a big, important turning point in U.S. foreign policy.
Could you talk to the operation itself? Documents and, I guess, the historian reports on the operation was classified until last couple of years when New York Times published the history by written by Donald Wilbur. Could you speak to those as well?
Do you want me to describe the operation or the document?
Yeah, well, maybe we'll start with document, how it was declassified.
Yeah, well, there have been two main sources, really three main sources of information about the coup itself. The first really was the head of the coup operation, Kermit Roosevelt, who was the grandson of U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt and who was the head of Middle East covert operations at the time. He published a memoir of the coup, which came out in the fall of 1979, just a couple of weeks before the U.S. embassy was taken in Iran. And he described in considerable detail the coup, although he made various mistakes and, you know, and wasn't entirely clear about things. So that came out and really revealed quite clearly that the U.S. had been involved and what it all consisted of. Then, secondly, in the 1980s, I was able to interview almost all of the CIA officers who were involved, as well as some British officials and even a few Iranians who were involved in one way or another. And so I got a lot of additional information from those sources. And then finally, it just happened that this was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I think 3 years ago now, the New York Times somehow got hold of a 200-page internal study that the CIA had commissioned a year or so after the coup, which was a detailed overview of the coup. This was written by Donald Wilbur, who was an adjunct professor at Princeton and a part-time CIA employee. He's an architectural historian, very famous figure, you know, scholar of Iran who died a few years ago. He had been the main planner of the coup. And so then after the coup, he was commissioned to write, you know, the official history of it. And this was meant to be sort of a document that the CIA would have, which would be kind of like a blueprint for future coups or, you know, an official history that could be referred back to when CIA was planning coups elsewhere. And so anyway, that document somehow was obtained by the CIA. It's not clear how, I'm sorry, by the New York Times. It's not clear how the New York Times got it. But in any case, they got hold of it, the full copy. And then after talking to myself and a few other people, they decided that they would blank out most of the names. Mm-hmm. But, you know, other than that, they published the full thing on their website about 3 years ago. And then they made a mistake, actually, in the way they published it. So various people, including myself, were able to obtain most of the names that had been blanked out. So, you know, most of the details came out. So those are the sources of information. And all in all, they, you know, they give you a very detailed overview of how the coup occurred. There isn't really too much that is left unknown, although there is a little bit, you know, mainly about which Iranians were involved in certain crucial details. But on the American side, it's all very clear now how it all happened.
Mark Gasiorowski, professor of political science at Louisiana State University, speaking with Gudarz Ektedari of community radio station KABU in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, my name is Benta Brooklyn, and I'm a production assistant for Peace Watch. I believe Peace Watch is an important program because it covers news and current affairs from a fresh and enlightening perspective. We need your support in order to continue. Please make a financial commitment by visiting our secure website at pacifica.org. Or you may send us a tax-exempt donation via check or money order addressed to Peace Watch, Pacifica, 2390, that's 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., 20009. Thank you so much for your support. Keep listening and tell your friends.
Finally, tonight, as we witness the birth of a burgeoning anti-war movement that filled the streets of major cities and captured the world's attention in the lead-up to the war on Iraq, we're going to take a step back to look at one of a group of political dissidents who captured the headlines during the Vietnam War. During the 1960s, a group of young students who had protested against the war became frustrated with how they were unable to affect major political change. Calling themselves the Weathermen, they decided to take up arms to overthrow the U.S. government. Jerry Quickly of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke recently with Sam Green, one of the filmmakers of a new documentary entitled The Weather Underground.
A documentary about a group that was called the Weather Underground, and they were a group of idealistic students at the end of the 60s. They protested against the war and racism and got to a point where they were so frustrated with how little things had changed that they got to a point where they took up armed struggle. They wanted to overthrow the U.S. government. And through the 70s, they did a campaign of symbolic bombings of corporate and government buildings and did 25 different targets, including the Capitol, before the group fell apart at the end of the decade. These days, they have been pretty forgotten, but during their day, they were a big deal.
Yeah, very, very much a big deal. And they grew out of the SDS, is that right?
Exactly.
Right, and
Students for Democratic Society.
Let's take a listen to a clip from the film, and then we'll come back and talk about it a little bit more.
A federal grand jury in Detroit today charged the 13 top leaders of the Weathermen with plotting to bomb public buildings in Chicago, Detroit, New York, and Berkeley, California. The Weathermen are the militant faction of the Students for a Democratic Society. Only one of the 13 is now in custody.
At 7:30 this morning, KPFK received a call from a woman identifying herself as a member of the Weather Underground.
Hello. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weathermen Underground. Kids know the lines are drawn. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Freaks are revolutionaries, and revolutionaries are freaks. If you want to find us, this is where we are. In every tribe, commune, dormitory, farmhouse, barracks, and townhouse, where kids are making love, smoking dope, and loading guns, fugitives from American justice are free to go. Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
The FBI said the Weather Underground organization, which took credit for the bombing, is the same radical group which was responsible for the bombing of the U.S. Capitol in 1971 and the Pentagon in 1972. But federal officials don't really know much about the group, which is believed to have between 20 and 30 members.
My name is Bernadine Dorn, and I was part of the Weather Underground from, well, it's hard to say when it started, 1970 to 1980. It's underground for 11 years.
There's no way to be committed to nonviolence in the middle of the most violent society that history's ever created. I'm not committed to nonviolence in any way.
I'm a teacher now in a community college, and my students will occasionally bring up the war in Vietnam and ask me what my involvement was. And I'll say, well, I helped found an organization whose goal was the violent overthrow of the government of the United States. And people would, my students would look at me as if I'm from another planet.
This system is going to be overthrown. It's going to mean a fight. And it's going to mean a lot of white people risking a lot of things when they finally join on the side of the black people and the people of Vietnam and around the world who have already begun the fight.
not going to tell you, oh, I walked in here this day and put a bomb here, or I made this here, or I blew up this car, or I held up this bank. I mean, there were armed robberies. They were all armed robberies, terrorism. You know, there was all kinds of things that went down that were illegal. So I tell you that we did them. But I'm not going to tell you which ones I did or who did what, because I just can't do that.
My name's David Gilbert. I'm now in Comstock Prison doing a life bid. In terms of mistakes we made, I'm willing to take responsibility, pay a price. I really haven't complained too much about my own personal situation. But was I fighting for a just cause? Was that the motivation? Was there a need to do something about what was going on? Yes, there was.
And that's a clip from The Weather Underground, a new film by Sam Green and Bill Siegel. Out of the folks that were in The Weather Underground, how many of them actually ended up in jail serving any kind of significant sentence, not in jail pending trial, but how many people were involved and how many of them served time? And for what type of crimes can you describe that they were charged with and or convicted of?
Yeah, the question how many people were involved is a hard question because it wasn't a card-carrying organization. So in the beginning, when it was just called the Weathermen and they were more above ground, there were a couple hundred people involved living in different cities around the country. But as they went underground, it got smaller, and as the years went by, it got smaller still. So at the end, it may have been 50 people, but one thing that's important to remember is they were able to elude the FBI for so many years because they had a lot of help. So there were people who might not have been members of the group, but were certainly helping them out.
Mm-hmm.
There was certainly more than just the core group that were involved.
I wanted to ask a little bit about, because one of the things I really liked about the film was the arc that you create with the story, how you very, 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 very effectively display how they went from kind of these student, you know, kind of spirited, you know, very politically minded, rebellious young student leaders into what was really an active clandestine terrorist organization, and who were at times even mercenary. And as much as, you know, they were hired themselves out to spring Timothy Leary, to break him out of jail and spirit him out of the country. And they were paid some $20,000, and there was, and you really do a wonderful job of tracing how this happened. Like, how did it evolve into the various iterations that it eventually formed, and particularly as they crossed the line to justify what they did in terms of planning the murders of people that they didn't even know. You know, when they're planning on bombing the officers, the NCO club, a non-commissioned officers dance, and how they began to justify it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I the more I learned about the story, we had been working on the film for about 4 years, and I had always known something about the Weather Underground. I remember reading about the group as a teenager. I'm younger than that generation. I'm in my mid-30s. And then about 5 years ago, I met somebody who was in the group, and I was really interested because I'd never known that these were just sort of normal people. And this guy was just a regular guy living here in San Francisco where I live. And I started to talk to him about the story. I'd go over to his house as much as I can. And I was really struck by the fact that the version of the story that he told me was really complicated and complex and morally ambiguous. It was hard to tell what was right and what was wrong. And I think that the more I understood about the context, the more what they did was understandable. I'm not saying that I would have done it myself, but it was understandable. And so I just thought that the story raised a lot of important questions and issues, especially for younger people, and that the more one could flesh out that context and show how people go from idealism to armed struggle, the more compelling and engaging and productive the documentary would be.
How willing were the Weather Underground members to talk to you? I mean, apparently, obviously, you got, you know, a group of them to speak with you. How hard was it to track them down, find them, and gain their interest and trust enough to speak as candidly and frankly with you as they do in the film?
It was a pretty difficult undertaking. It took a while to get in touch with people, and then most of them were pretty skeptical, and I think felt the less that they said, the better. This was, all the interviews were done before September 11th, so it was less of a tense subject then.
Yeah.
But still, everything that had been written about the group up till that point was really negative and played up the drugs and sex and played down the context. And I think without the context, they seem really nutty. It's only with the context that they start to seem reasonable in a lot of ways.
Exactly. So, that's the exact word I was going to use. They seem very reasonable in many ways.
Yeah. I was always struck in talking to them that they're all very articulate and intelligent people. They're not crazy, and I certainly wouldn't call them terrorists. But so it took a while just for us to impress upon people that this was an independent project. We were younger people trying to make sense of that period of time and that story, not to give baby boomers a ride down memory lane, but really for our generation to understand the past better so as to better understand the present. I mean, that's mm-hmm. really our goal with the project.
Right.
After a while, I think people started to understand that that's where we were coming from and grew more comfortable.
Sam Green is one of the filmmakers behind the new documentary, The Weather Underground. He spoke with Jerry Quickly of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. For more information on the film, visit its website at www.weatherunderground.com. Thanks to Fidel Rodriguez for production assistance with that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at Pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.